podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Lou Mizell of the Louis K. Mizell Gallery in New York City. We're talking about the Yigal Ozeri, a New York Story exhibition. He's a photorealist painter who does some really stunning work that has some real photographic quality to it. It's really breathtaking. Enjoy! But first, a word from our new sponsor. I'm so excited about this new sponsor, guys. I've used Walgreens.com for years. In fact, they were drugstore.com when I first started using them. They have such great deals, and I can create my own little drugstore stockpile of things like deodorant, toothpaste, soap, face cream, things I definitely don't want to run out of. They've got such great deals, especially for buying in bulk, that you never have to do without. And every order over $35 gets you free shipping. If you go to the letstalkartwithbrooke.com page and click on the link, you'll get special deals only available to the Let's Talk Art with Brooke listeners. Now on to my interview with Lou Mizell. Awesome, I'm turning you on. Hang on 1 second. Cool, we're on speaker. How you doing?
Good.
Awesome. So you got a big opening today, correct?
Yep, today we're opening the private part of the Ozeri. It's the first time we've done a two-night opening. So tonight is for about 50 very special invited guests that have his work and have followed it for a long time. And then tomorrow night it's open to the public. And it'll be probably a big scene here like they used to have in Chelsea in the recent years.
Cool, cool. And how do you pronounce his name? It's
Ozeri.
Ozeri. And how do you pronounce his first name?
Yigal Ozeri.
Cool. And he's Israeli, right?
He was born in Israel. He's been here for about 30 years.
Cool.
Lives in the East, in the West Village.
Mm-hmm.
Has a major studio at this art center called Mana in Jersey City.
Nice. Right. And I noticed on your website, you say that, that this work moves away from objectifying women and is more socially conscious. What do you mean by that?
Say it again, please.
You feel that this work moves away from objectifying women and is more socially conscious?
Right. Well, what he generally does is he'll hire a model or ask someone who he kind of finds interesting to look at, if he can photograph them for the purpose of making paintings. And then they'll meet on the beach, in the fields, in the woods. He actually went to Costa Rica with one girl to walk around in the jungle.
Oh, wow.
And it starts off with him talking and walking and taking a few pictures. And pretty soon, everybody kind of forgets that the camera is working, and it's a digital camera, and he may take 3,000 pictures in a matter of 1, 2, 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
And then he'll go through all that over the next week or two and come up with about 30 images he feels would make nice, interesting paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you paint a beautiful female nude today, someone's going to complain about it. Someone's going to get sensitive about it. Someone's going to say you're objectifying women.
Mm-hmm.
However, since the very beginning of time, artists have been painting and drawing nude women.
Correct.
We're living in a very interesting, amusing, strange time right now.
I agree.
So his work has included a lot of nudes, but not all. And there's always a lot of beautiful women, but they're not all beautiful.
Right.
But in this latest show, he has now come in from the outdoors and the more Mm-hmm. And he has his girls, his models, his women in the subways walking around Chinatown, coming out of sleazy shops, sitting on the steps in a subway, walking in crowds around NYU with a bunch of students. And some of them are, you know, just anonymous people.
Mm-hmm.
There are no news. They're all figures of dress.
Mm-hmm.
In some way, there's a bit more, maybe, what the critics will call substance and social consciousness, which is what everybody wants to see and hear now. But he didn't do this or even think about all those aspects while shooting for this particular series.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that occurred to him that would make interesting paintings.
Right.
And you've seen a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm. They're beautiful.
And, well, compared to earlier ones, some of those words I use might apply. It's just a beautiful girl, or more than one beautiful girl. And he's got Asians and blacks and whites and Russians and Polish and all sorts of different people. He's not thinking about, you know, do I have a diversification or not? He just, there's people he sees and he says, I think you make great painting. I'd like you to pose for him.
Right, right. Not diversity for diversity's sake, just people he finds.
He's not, it happens to be, but he's not thinking about that. He's not making a statement.
Mm-hmm.
He's just painting what he feels makes beautiful paintings, and that's what he does.
Right, right. Does he only do the photorealist stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
That's all he's doing right now.
Cool.
He started off many years ago. There was always some kind of a realist painting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at one point he had a studio in the downtown area on an alleyway, and he saw pigeons nesting on his windowsill. And he looked out the window from his painting, his easel, and he painted pictures of the pigeons on the windowsills.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't use the camera. It wasn't photorealism. It was his close interpretation, as realist as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, probably about 10 years ago, he decided to start gathering information with the camera,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the sketch pad or some other method. And it's gravitated into some of the best photorealism that I've ever seen.
Yeah, totally.
And you have to know that when I started doing this back in the 70s, people kind of, some dealers said, Lou, how can you make a living on an artist that does one, two, or three paintings a year? And other people said, well, what are you doing realism for? And, you know, we had abstract expressionism.
Right.
Yeah, but that was like 20 years ago, and pop art came along, and new realism came along, and based on the return of that,
right.
A number of artists have gone beyond what anybody else ever did,
mm-hmm.
in realist painting, and they're using a tool called a camera, which all through the beginning of the last century, artists denied.
Mm-hmm.
Although we know that just about every artist
uses
that
one.
Needed it could use that tool,
yeah.
including Aikens and Homer and, you know,
right.
the rest of them.
Right. Well, that's kind of my next question. I was kind of, and I wasn't really sure how to word it. But so photorealism is a different thing than just regular painting. It's, obviously you want to be as real as possible, but like if you're, I guess my question is, how do you decide to do like just a picture, like a good picture of a person, than do a picture that is a photo, would be considered a photorealist picture, if that makes any sense.
First of all, in my 50 years, and in the four volumes of my book that basically document almost every painting,
mm-hmm.
by every one of the photorealists for the 50 years,
mm-hmm.
I have only found 50 artists.
Mm-hmm.
I get maybe five a decade if I'm lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to know that after I started doing this, and as I was saying, I was the only one really besides O.K. Harris, I got to see 500 or 1,000 artists a year because I was the gallery that any realist of any sort would send his pictures into first,
mm-hmm.
because I became known for that. So I really got to see anything and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I know more realists and I'm friends with more than anybody. And by the way, there's 500 out there that are brilliant artists,
mm-hmm.
that are not photorealists. I mean, you have, Alex Katz is a friend of mine. He's across the street.
Uh-huh.
And Philip Perlstein and Tillman, Bruder, and it goes on and on. There's a lot of good realism out there, but the photorealists, for one thing, their imagery really has come from pop art.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of it, you know, and they're shooting and doing things that other people might not have ever even thought of doing, number one.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just give you a quick jocular background.
Sure.
Let's go back 150 years.
Okay.
The camera was invented.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, even though the camera today makes it possible for the greatest realist paintings ever, the camera actually began the decline of imagery in painting, because up until that point,
right,
all through history, 15,000 years, artists recorded and reported faces, places, and things.
Mm-hmm.
Portrait to life on landscape.
Mm-hmm.
The caveman made a painting on a cave wall of a hunt.
Mm-hmm.
With them chasing, okay, it was reporting. All of a sudden, the camera comes along, and now here's my joke, which should actually be stated in French, but I can only say in English. The English is, hey, there's cameras here. We don't have to do that anymore. And who said that?
Yeah.
Who said it in French? In French, you had Manet and Monet and Renoir and Cezanne, and these are the artists in France. And they're kind of sitting around, and one of them says to the other in French, hey, there's cameras here. We don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
And the Impressionists are the ones that began to move away from what recording and reporting, religious imagery, any kind of imagery all through history. And then the Post-Impressionists, you got to Cubism.
Mm-hmm.
And you had Picasso, Leger, and Braque. And there was still imagery,
mm-hmm,
but it had nothing to do with realism or anything. You went on farther and you had the Surrealists.
Right.
They were doing things out of their mind, and, you know, Dali and Tanguy and Ernst and,
mm-hmm,
all those, the artists like that. And finally, you got to the Abstract Expressionists, who eliminated any kind of imagery completely.
Mm-hmm.
So the camera began to lead the way to that.
Cool.
After Abstract Expressionism, you had Rivers and Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, and they were abstract painters who started bringing images back in. Rivers with his Dutch masters, for instance, and Johns with his flags, and Rauschenberg with actual screens of photographs and everything else. And then you had Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein and Wesselman and Ramos and what we call the legitimate pop artists.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, imagery now had returned, but for those artists, it returned in a way that never existed before.
Mm-hmm.
Scale, imagery, surface, composition. And it opened a way for a lot of artists to start painting realism again. And we had, in the 60s, a lot of people called the New Realists.
Mm-hmm.
There were maybe 100 that are notable. I gave you a few names a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle of the 60s, I met Malcolm Morley.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean anything to you?
No.
Malcolm was a British artist, and he was painting large, beautiful pictures of ocean liners from postcards.
Ooh.
Now, some people will claim that he was a preliminary to photorealism. In reality, he was late pop art,
mm-hmm,
because it was the postcard picture of an ocean liner was the same thing as a Campbell soup can, except that he painted with a lot more detail. About the same time, an artist named Robert Bechtel in California took a picture with his camera outside his studio window, and you see the window and you see the blinds, and out in the street there's a car. And he took that image, which nobody else would have ever thought of painting, and he made a painting of it almost exactly from the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the first of the photorealists.
Uh-huh.
Shortly thereafter, I saw Chuck Close, and you know who that is.
Yep.
The big faces, and Richard Estes,
mm-hmm,
with his street scenes, and Audrey Flack and Charlie Bell with still lifes.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got to the end of the 60s, we had a group of artists that I kind of put together in my gallery on Madison Avenue, and they were using the camera. They were telling everybody, of course we're using it. It's a tool. So,
mm-hmm,
the camera, which began the beginning of the elimination of realism, now it became a tool for artists to gather information to make the paintings that I end up accidentally calling photorealism,
uh-huh,
and which ended up becoming the word that stuck.
Huh.
And that kind of gives you a run-through. So now, again, you have Faces, Places, and Things. Mm-hmm. Chuck Close was the Faces.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike anything that ever existed before, they're 9 feet high, black and white. They were incredible when we first saw them. Everybody says, holy, you know, holy shit, or whatever. What is that? And then Richard Estes would go out and take pictures of street scenes. Mm-hmm. Just street scenes. Nothing important at the time, but streets. And he painted them. And Audrey Plack and Charlie Bell were doing these giant still lifes. Charlie Bell did gumball machines and pinball machines and toys and marbles. Audrey was doing all sorts of things that she found on her dressing table.
Mm-hmm.
As a woman, she had different shiny objects and things.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you had all the artists back then, well, let's say there were 20. Every one of them had to invent their own technique, because in the 50s and 60s, there was no place where any artist could go where they would teach you how to paint realism.
Right.
It was sneered at. And to this day, nobody's teaching anybody how to paint realism.
No, so not that I know of.
If there's 50 artists, then there's 50 artists that invented their own way of painting.
Wow.
Now, Richard Estes had a 35mm camera,
mm-hmm,
and Kodachrome and Ektachrome. And film was not expensive to you and me, but it might have been expensive to these artists back then. Mm-hmm. So he'd go out and he'd take a roll of film, 24 or 32 images.
Mm-hmm.
And he would then go back with what he had from that equipment and make his paintings. Nowadays, the photorealists of the digital age, of which Osiri is one,
mm-hmm,
they have digital cameras and computers. So we have an artist like Bertrand Meniel,
mm-hmm,
who is the Estes of today,
mm-hmm,
and his paintings contain more more information,
mm-hmm,
than any artist in history. And he says, I have a 36 megapixel camera,
mm-hmm,
large format, cost me $40,000. He says, if I can see it, I can paint it.
Wow.
And he may take 50 pictures of a whole area around Broadway. And then he may go to his computer, and from the thousands of pictures, he's got to take this and that and this and that and this person and, mm-hmm, this car and everything else and create an image,
uh-huh,
that looks exactly like what a street scene on Broadway would look like.
Right.
And he's got the equipment and he's using it.
Right.
And there's no reason why he shouldn't. And they are not denying it, and it's really part of what photorealism is.
Right.
Now, that was a long diatribe. I hope you got something from
it. Yeah, I did. I have a couple of points I want to touch on. So basically you're saying that, and I sort of was trying to word this question right, but I wanted to kind of find out how you learned quote unquote photorealism, but I guess you're saying that each artist kind of has to teach themselves or find out through trial and error.
There's an artist named Don Eddy, and he was the youngest one, and back in the early 70s, he kind of appeared in New York and he was painting cars and things like that. And in my discussions with him, I said, gee, how did this start? He says, well, you know, my father owned a garage in Los Angeles called Eddie's Garage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if anybody goes back to those years, you know that Eddie's Garage produced some of the greatest custom-made and painted cars that were on the road. And Don, as a young kid, got an airbrush and was doing the pinstriping and painting on his father's cars,
mm-hmm,
for people that were commissioning it. That's how he started. And all of his paintings are done with an airbrush.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Each artist has found a way to make marks. In my first book, I have on one page, I think, 9 3-inch squares.
Mm-hmm.
And those 3-inch squares are from 9 different artists, and I explained by looking at those 3-inch squares that you can tell who the artist is,
mm-hmm,
by the brushwork, because, mm-hmm, they are all different. Some do it one way, some do it another way, and they all had to figure it out. How do you get the image from your photograph to the canvas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were two prime methods. One is to project a 35mm slide on the canvas,
mm-hmm,
in semi-darkness, go up and draw in where different things are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can take the photograph and hold it up close to you, match colors with your palette, and then go in and paint in those areas. The second method is the old English way of the grid method,
mm-hmm,
where you take an 8x10 photograph and you grid it into quarter-inch squares,
mm-hmm,
and you take a big canvas and grid it into 3-inch squares,
right,
and then you count square number 87 down and number 37 across, and you see what it is, and you go up and you try to put that information,
right,
in position, and you get, so that's a method.
Right.
Some artists actually photosensitized the canvas and had a very, very pale image projected, and it shows up on the canvas, which is then painted over. But they've all invented their own technique, their own method. It's not like in the old days, back in the old master days, where you worked for a major artist and you all learned his technique, and that's how you painted.
Right. Huh, that's interesting. And also, I never really thought about, I mean, there's people who say, you know, oh, that abstract art, that doesn't look like anything. But actually, with the invention of the camera, I guess, is that kind of when abstract art started? Just kind of doing, like, okay, we don't need to do this, so we can do our own. I don't know if that's the actual thought process that went through, but is that what you're...
Somehow or other, it's not coming across clear. Are you actually...
I'm sorry. I was saying I never thought about it, that the invention of the camera could have given the artist freedom to do more abstract stuff. Like, they wouldn't necessarily be looking for realism.
That's what I said. Back then, the Impressionists no longer felt that they had to paint like the old masters. They had to paint like, you know, the classic realist painters. They could make their impressions of things. Was it really because a camera had taken over that area of recording and reporting things? I don't know. That's just kind of a jokey idea. But the reality is that the camera took over actually making realist imagery and recording and reporting. And, of course, when you get up into the middle of the 20th century, all the magazines and all the newspapers that used to have artists illustrate and make paintings and etchings and whatever to illustrate what they were doing, now the camera was doing it. So the camera freed up artists from having to do that, or it said, we don't need you anymore to do that, so, you know, go find something else to do.
Right, go find another way, which they did.
There's a million different things that make what happened in art happen.
Right. That's so cool. I guess I might have on a conscious level known that, but I don't think I ever like really thought it through that way.
There's so many unknowable things, and for the greatest art that we have, while we say, oh, let's say that, you know, the artist would go into the academy and study in the ground floor, all the rooms, and go up to the next floor and spend years looking at everything that went before, 3,000 years of history, the Jansen book, and you get up to the top floor, and knowing everything and seeing everything, ideas begin to occur to you. Well, maybe I can change this, or maybe I can do that, and you build the next floor. Unfortunately, nowadays, too many artists think that, you know, I don't have to learn, I don't have to study, I don't have to look. I can take a helicopter up there to the 100th floor, or to the left someplace, and step out and build. Well, no, you fall.
Right.
You know, I think that up until the very most recent ages, where almost anything goes, artists really had to be influenced or guided or affected by what came before.
Right.
Then you also have outliers. You have folk artists that don't know anything about the art world and create things out of stones and sticks and pebbles and shells and fabrics and whatever. So, again, that's another whole art world, and it's just as legitimate in reality. It's human creativity.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. So, yeah, I just think that's so cool. So let's talk a little bit about your book.
My own personal book?
Yeah, your autobiography.
Well, I've written about 20 books.
Cool.
And they're all basically on art and art history. One of them is on an English Deco potter, Clarice Clip. I've written the definitive books on pinup paintings and pinup artists. I'm the biggest collector in all those areas. And then there's other collections that I have that I've written small things about. But over my years, I have thousands of stories. Mm-hmm. And everybody has kept saying, Lou, you got to write about it. You got to write the book. So about 3 years ago, I came up with the title. Mm-hmm. And the title is, Okay, I'll Do It.
That's funny.
And I then set down the titles or a list of 500 anyway, maybe more, stories. And I interviewed a few ghostwriters because I got to have somebody to do this. I'll tell the stories and somebody has to write it. And I actually got started, and I, you know, wrote a few dozen, and it's like, it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And the ghostwriter thing, it's just too hard even communicating. I almost have to write it, and then they have to edit it. And I've just had many things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I started, my staff has said, listen, at least start a blog.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a blog on my website, and I've told the first few stories starting back in the 50s when I was 14 and I walked into the Museum of Modern Art for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the artists that I met back then when I was just a young groupie hanging on, and I knew Rothko and
mm-hmm.
Klein and Stamos, and then how I met Warhol, got to be good friends with Wesselman and Lichtenstein and Ramos, who I represent to this day.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to do it.
Cool.
When is it going to happen? Will it happen?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Right.
It's something that you know, I was in Detroit, no, I was in Flint Institute on last Saturday, and I did a lecture. And in that hour-long lecture, people heard a dozen of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever I go, I'm telling them, and some people remember, some won't, but somewhere out there, the stories are there.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So
cool.
There isn't more to it right now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, yeah, I really encourage you to write the book. I think people would love to read it. And I know how hard it is. I know it's a tough thing writing a book. But yeah, stick with it, because I think I would love to read it. I think a lot of people would.
Well, I hope to get it done sometime. If you go to my website, you can read some of the first chapters.
Cool. I will. So, well, it was so great talking to you, Lou.
Okay. You got enough material?
I think so.
Okay.
Cool. So
now, how is this? Is this going to be? How do you publish this?
Well, I have a blog called Let's Talk Art with Brooke, and you can go.
Right, I looked at that. So yeah. I guess you could send me this once you get it printed up, or however you're going
to
do it.
I'll send you a link to it. Yeah, I'll send you the post. And also, if you go to iTunes, that's probably the you can get it there. You can get it. It's either you can go to the website or you can go to iTunes. It's probably easier, okay. I guess, to go to the website. But I'll send you a link.
Okay.
Cool.
Okay.
So I appreciate it, and I will definitely keep in touch, and I will follow what you're doing, and hope to get your book.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much to Lou Mizell for talking with me about the Yigal Ozarius Show. And thank you to you for listening. If you're in the New York City area, he's got the big opening for it tonight. The exhibition goes until June 9th. Thanks for listening. This is a Hotspur Media production. Music by Fleslet.